You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. On September 23rd and 24th, at the Lenzic, the Santa Fe Institute's 2019 ULAM Lecture Series goes to the forefront of infectious disease research. Join epidemiologist Lauren Ansel Myers to learn how scientists use social media and internet search data to save lives, and how the science of networks may help prevent the next pandemic. These two lectures are self-contained and can be enjoyed together or separately. Free tickets are available at ticketsantafe.org. Support for the Radio Cafe comes from Lannan Foundation, presenting Boots Riley in conversation with Robin D.G. Kelly on Wednesday, September 11th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic in Santa Fe. Boots Riley is the writer-director of the comedy fantasy sci-fi film Sorry to Bother You, and a provocative and prolific poet, rapper, songwriter, producer, and community organizer. Tickets available at the Lenzic or lenzic.org. I'm very happy now to welcome Dr. Corinne Sanchez. She's executive director of Tewa Women United, and we're talking on the occasion of the organization's 30th anniversary. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So 30 years. Tell us how Tewa Women United started and what's it all about.
So Tewa Women United started in the late 80s. And it really came from women coming together and talking, as we do as women, around tables in homes and about things that they were experiencing. One of the members participated in a Women in Transition support group and kind of brought in other women to that group, and then it expanded and grew. And so I think from there, just the talking and the sharing of similar experiences, similar frustrations, similar challenges around life in our Pueblo communities. And from that, I think then invited in more women. And then that was the seed, and that's how it grew.
It sort of reminds me the way you're talking about of those consciousness-raising groups in the 1960s where women would come together and found out that they had all these things that they thought were their own secrets that turned out they had in common with others.
Yes, very similar. I think women just naturally kind of come together and share and talk. Like, so women from your families, women from different communities. And I feel like those peer support circles are really the strength of a lot of our communities, and a hidden strength that people don't always necessarily recognize and talk about and embrace, but just the companionship and really sharing life experiences.
How did it come to be all women? Did that just evolve naturally?
Well, it was a woman support group. So I think that the recognition at that time from the women was that there were no spaces in our communities for women's voices or women to gather and talk about things that impacted them, not just on a personal level, but also on a political level, whether they're coming from different communities, whether they were experiencing mixed marriages, you know, just the whole continuum of our life and what we bring to. And I think they recognized that there was not that space and really, really were craving it.
What are some of the kinds of problems that you guys originally got together and talked about? And, you know, on the one hand, women's problems are pretty universal. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's some things really specific to Native people and Pueblos. Mm.
So the early circles, I think, were just around personal experiences, witnessing violence, experiencing violence directed at them, helping family members through different types of transitions, whether that's, you know, aging and then death, raising children on your own, divorce, verbal abuse. I mean, you just name it. It was there. Economic challenges and intergenerational family issues and dynamics. I remember one of the first kind of like real programs or projects we had was our Akingtung, which was to help individuals who are going through substance abuse and issues and challenges, and how we could pull on our culture as a strength to overcome those challenges. And then for us, it was also really a big opening around understanding trauma and how trauma moves through families, moves through generations. And at that time, in the early years, was really looking at Maria Yellowhor's Bravehearts research around unresolved historical grief, and then being able to talk with Dr. Eduardo Duran and his former partner, Bonnie, around post-colonial psychology. So really then really understanding historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, then individual complex trauma. And so I think in those consciousness raising circles, it really is like that critical thinking and being able to process and analyze and reflect on your situation, because when you're in it, right? And then being able to have the space to then share and talk, and then also recognizing that things needed to change and how could we make that change happen. And the women in those original circles were about, you know, like healing themselves and then healing community and family. And so really recognizing that as we do our individual work, we're really impacting the broader community and the broader society. So when we talk about healing ourselves means healing our ancestors and transforming the future of our children, that was very much the experience of the lived experience of these women.
Talk about historical trauma and what that looks like here in New Mexico, and then how that affects individual women's lives. Because I think sometimes, you know, the past is lost on us, and mm-hmm. we try to blame ourselves too much for things that actually happened a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of research that has come forward around the impact of historical traumas like the Holocaust and shared experiences of genocide in different countries and communities. And so part of the historical trauma for us as Indigenous peoples to America here has been, you know, contact, right? Here in New Mexico, we talk about the three waves of colonization. So the Mexican government, the Spanish government, and then the U.S. government. And how that has impacted our communities, you know, pueblos, where like we have a very specific political stance, as opposed to other Indigenous populations across the country. We have land grants here in New Mexico, which gives us a different status. But then you also look at law and historical records, which also still talks to us as savages, as less than. And so those are part of the historical traumatic experiences. And then you have laws and policies that different governments impose upon tribal Indigenous communities. So court systems and educational systems and things that were foreign to our communities before that time, right? And so when we talk about trying to describe this experience, we've developed what we call our trauma healing rocks, which is a visual to really explain. Because the first thing that happens for people is the feelings, right? The feelings of loneliness, of anger, of guilt, of shame, of all of it that comes from being dehumanized in a process that doesn't recognize your language, doesn't recognize your culture, doesn't recognize the practices that you have done for thousands of years. And then to then have another foreign body come in and say, you know, you don't understand, we don't understand your language, so you don't have a language. You know, there's very few people here, so, you know, you don't need all this space, right? And so then we talk about the displacement of communities. Fortunately for us in New Mexico, we have been able to hold on to some of our most sacred lands, and other communities have not been as fortunate as us across the country. But this is a history that none of us really learn or know about how America was actually founded, you know, because it wasn't found. I'm like, it existed. And so how do we then understand that within educational systems that are placed upon you, then you have intergenerational disconnect. In this day and age, we have, you know, young kids as young as 3 years old that have grown up with computers and phones, and everybody has one in their hand. And some of us generations haven't had that, and there's a disconnect. And you know, I go to restaurants and I see people on their phones and not really engaging. And kids have this idea of virtual friends as opposed to real friends. And so all of that in our trauma rock exercise, we talk about the bags that get filled with these rocks that are these different types of traumas that happen. And none of us are immune from trauma, like, right? We get hit, our body gets a nick, we get a bruise, that's a trauma on our body. We have words that are said in whether intentionally or not intentionally that cause harm, right? We don't know what other people are going through and we make a slight comment and somebody is hurt. So I think the recognition of all of those and how they just compound, or what we call exponential growth. So you can see it visually growing in the rocks as it passes through generations. And then some of us may experience a traumatic situation, say a rape or an assault, and that we don't talk about and we don't share because of a lot of different reasons.
What are some of those reasons?
So just there are just so many different reasons people don't come forward. I mean, we're in this moment of Me Too and highly visible sexual assault, sexual abuse instances within sports teams, within, you know, churches, within society, right? And so what we found in our circles is that the majority of the women that came to our circles had an experience of sexual violence in their lifetime. And what we know now in the research is that 1 in 3 Native women is going to experience sexual assault. And so the reasons why people don't come forward, one is like what we see in high profile cases right now is like victim blaming, horrendous assaults that have occurred and there has been no justice. People walk. People are still at that stage where it's like, well, she didn't scream. She didn't yell. She didn't, all these things that you should have done or shouldn't have done, like, or she was wearing the wrong clothes. It's just a lot of judgment. It's a lot of fear of retaliation. The majority of rapes that occur in my personal experience are done by people that the victim or survivor knows. And, you know, being able to challenge, you know, someone that's not in your family and report something, and then the opposite of that is having somebody really close to you, your family member, your tribal member, your community member, your congregation member, assaulting or raping you, and the fear of not being believed, the fear of being belittled. There's just so much.
Right.
So for me, it's my background is in child sexual abuse and sexual violence work, and it's amazing how many times even family members do not support people that have had an experience, or people make you doubt what you experienced, right? And so I think the pervasiveness of where we're at right now in this country with the current administration that we have and the history of his personal behaviors around sexual assault, sexual abuse, comments verbally, I mean, it's, we're at a place where, you know, it's accepted as the norm. And that impacts the trauma rocks that you're carrying around the visibility, around being able to claim space, being able to be present, all of those things. And so part of the healing trauma rock exercise is our ability to open the bags and to really look at the different traumas that a person or community or family has experienced and begin to talk about it. Right? The more that we talk about it, the more that the survivors have stepped forward is us now realizing how much of an epidemic it is in our community. But there's also fear around how to address it. There's also fear around a lot of different things that men have, privileges that they feel they're going to lose if we talk about, you know, and not all men rape, not all community members are violent, you know, recognizing that as well. But also when certain communities are targeted for violence directed at them. We have in our communities right now people who are being held in cages just because of the color of their skin or the place that they were born, right? And so how do we really think about the impact that has when we know for ourselves as social beings, the biggest need that we need as humans developing is connection and belonging. And if that's disrupted at an early, early age, then that just pulls forward a lot of other things that then get redirected or challenged. Or, you know, we are at this place and time around murdered and missing Indigenous women. And for me, my personal perspective on this is that it's come from this whole history of genocide and rape and assault and how that's been used to claim land, to claim space, to continue to practice. And because women have been afraid to speak out and say, whether it's against their family member, their community member, society's perspectives, they then get silenced. And then in that silencing becomes the invisibility. And then you get to this place of we have, 5,700 missing, murdered Indigenous women. And that's just Indigenous women because this is happening globally to all women, all races, all classes. And we need to be able to challenge it, speak out against it without fear of being murdered. And unfortunately, in 2019, there's a huge fear around being murdered because of the gun violence, because of access, because you can't just say no to somebody without them falling apart or attacking you, which speaks to a lot of then how are we raising community? How are we raising men and women and children to feel entitled to that particular expression of violence?
It's striking how little time it takes to inflict trauma and then how long it takes to heal.
Yes. I think our bodies and our minds and our spirits are very complex mechanisms that are happening, right? And the younger that you experience violence or trauma, that we know that it chemically alters different factors in your development, in your brain, in your emotions, and those imprints, And so if you're having multiple assaults or multiple attacks in different ways, then those are just continuing to be imprinted, and then your behavior becomes challenging. And then what people tend to do then is your behavior is challenging, then we're going to give you drugs, right? But then we know these drugs have all these side effects, and then it just goes on and on. And so how do we really come back to that healing piece around reclaiming all these different sides of us, all these different facets of who we are and our experiences, and make sense of them? And so it becomes important for us in our work as Teo Women United to really look at like the healing we're doing for ourselves and around our mind, our heart, our bodies, our spirits, because then that changes and shifts then the interactions that you have with other people. And then impacts their development or their change, or, where we say we don't want to use violent words. How do we shift that language? How do we have conversations that are challenging around race, class, gender? How do we agree to disagree? And how are we teaching those skills to our young people? How are we teaching them to everyone in our community to learn if we grow up in a home where there's just shouting and shouting and the person with the loudest voice is the one whose decisions were followed, how do you begin to unlearn that and change that in your interactions with other people? It is really complex and it takes a lot of positive energy, a lot of ability to move and to, I don't know, I feel like the trauma rocks for me have been around like the reconciliation, recognizing that people's behaviors don't always match their words. And also that there's also opportunity for people to change and grow.
We're talking to Corinne Sanchez of Tewa Women United. We'll be back in just a half a minute. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You were talking about the kind of disconnect between the different generations. And again, we see that everywhere, people on their devices and so on. And it's sort of like every generation is that much more distant from the next one because time seems to have been accelerating and there's so much innovation and all of that stuff, which is not always for the better. How do you work with people across generations? How do you get the young and not so young and older and very old people all talking to each other?
I think we've been fairly fortunate in our work to really always be doing intergenerational work because the women that came to the circles had children, they had grandchildren, and so that that dynamic has just always come through in our work.
Without having to make that much of an effort, because that's what people are doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's family and it's community. And so, and for us in looking at healing, like the individual can only do so much work. The community level, there also has to be change. And there also has to be change on a society level. And so we need to have interactions. We're interdependent. We are social animals, right? So we need the social interactions. We need to have that diversity in order for us to continue to grow and expand. And we need to hear multiple languages. We need to have it and come in different forms, because that's just who we are as intellectual beings. And so being able to have that is crucial. And our work, again, just it's evolved into like that piece, because as women, we know that we're the bearers of our children, we're the bearers of different aspects of cultural and holding family and community together. And so I think that's just been a natural flow of our work.
Did you grow up speaking your native language, Tewa?
No, I speak very little Tewa. I understand very little Tewa. And I think that was, for me, one of the biggest places I held shame around, and really trying to, you know, because again, intentional or unintentional words around, oh, you're not native enough, oh, you're too native, you know, all these different things that you hear growing up, and how do you make sense of it? But for Tewa Women United, we've always been about reclaiming our language, our traditions and our practices, and also understanding how colonization impacted some of those practices, right? Because in some places, the way women are treated is not necessarily traditional, quotes in my, I'm doing quotes with my hands, because I think those have been impacted as genocide and colonization has come into our lands, and those that held that memory or held that story were murdered or shut out or taken out of the narrative, right? And so for Tewa Women United, for us, it's been about how do we reclaim our stories as women? How do we reclaim our realities? And also, how do we continue to evolve as a culture, knowing that there are things we want to hold on to culturally, traditionally, and there are also things that need to shift and change. And every culture in this world evolves, right? We're continually evolving. Language evolves. Sometimes I feel like we're stuck in the ways that we're teaching our language now as Tewa people or Indigenous people, and putting it into a curricular context in a Western way, when language is really learned more fluidly. And so that becomes a challenge and an impediment. Because for me, when I was in high school, they offered Tewa, but I was like, I'm going to take French, because then I'm on the same level playing field of people, because not very many people speak French in our area. They speak Spanish, right? And so I was like, oh, I'm not going to go into Spanish, because everybody's going to be like getting A's and B's and I'm going to be struggling. I was like, I'm going to take French. But there's ways that our education can evolve to be able to embrace community organizations or tribal communities and really figure out how to then better bridge that language piece. And in our society as a whole, like, we've come to accept monolingualism as the top tier. And research, again, counters that with the more languages we speak, the more intelligent or the more fluent or the more fluid you are in movement, in trade, in commerce, in whatever else may be.
It's good for your mind. You can learn other languages after that.
The research around language is like, we only use certain percentage of our brain when we're talking English. When we talk other languages, it just lights up different areas. And so I think, you know, we have a long way to decolonize ourselves as a society around embracing diversity. Like, right, our crops are monocropped when we know diversity of ecosystems is what really the strength is. And so how can we get out of this mindset of that bigger is better or single is more, you know, it's just counter to all of our natural environments and our natural way of being.
I think the question of decolonizing our lives and decolonizing our minds is really profound, and it's for everybody to think about, mm-hmm. because we're all part of this, whatever mm-hmm. context we grew up in. And a lot of people are against the idea of colonialism and all the violence that goes along with that. And then the question, like, how do you do that? Like, what is that process? Like, for example, are the little ones being put with the Tewa elders so that they can learn the language in that more natural way?
But that was the natural way.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I'm like, when we think about, like, decolonizing, I think it's an amazing term, and it's also a struggle for all of us, no matter who we are, indigenous or not indigenous. We get comfortable in our patterns, we get comfortable in our behaviors, and it's hard to let go of, right? When we talk about race, it's about letting go of privilege. It's hard to let go of. We're talking about these different things around food, like, right? Like, my mom is big on not having a microwave, and I'm like, I grew up with a microwave. I'm like, I like the instant, warm it up, boom, it's done. And so I think those shifts and changes of, like, what we've come to be used to around what makes our life easier, but also recognizing that that is having an impact, and how do we change some of those behaviors.
And what's important, like, is it really important not to use a microwave as opposed to something else? Like, it's all those little choices every day that you don't, you know, you say letting go of your privilege. What does that actually look like when you get up in the morning?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's for all of us to reflect on. What does that mean? Like, what are the changes that I can do around creating less waste? What are the changes I can do around supporting businesses that don't support policies around LGBTQ or anti-discriminate, you know, that are discriminating against people? Like, I have a choice, right, to really make a decision. And yet it's also sometimes very hard, like, right? Like, there are certain businesses here in Santa Fe that I'm like, I'm not going to support, because I know that, like, this, they're supporting this thing, or this, they don't allow people to choose their own birth control, or all of these other aspects, right? And then it becomes like, well, then what's convenient? Then, like, where can I go? And we're all challenged in those ways. Like, we just had a birthday party and I bought balloons, even though I know, like, oh my God, there's, like, balloons in the ocean all over the place.
Right, right.
I think we need to, like, reflect and figure out and take those steps. And we need to have the courage to do it and overcome our fears. But that's not an easy thing to do. You know, as we're working with people with substance abuse and violence use and all of that, it's like, again, you know, what were they shown? What were they taught? What are these patterns, and how do we begin to change them? You know, any of us who've gone on a diet know that that's hard to do. Like, right? You need to
change your habits.
You need to commit, and you need to, like, do the practice. And so, getting into the practice of it, and we recognize that that's hard and challenging. And when we have our children, and we have family, and we have different things happening, things then just become easier because we can microwave it, right? Even though we know that it takes out the nutrients from our food.
Another piece of what you guys work on is, you ladies, you women, which is still the right word, is reproductive justice. What does that look like?
So reproductive justice can encompass a whole lot of things for us as women, non-gender conforming, LGBTQA. Like, there's just so much that it can incorporate. And being, again, the consciousness of that awareness around, for us as Indigenous women, that meant looking back at the history of colonization and genocide, and knowing that rape and assault were used to, in a sense, kind of breed out the native in people, which is horrible to think about. To also the place of sterilizing women because they were brown, because they were mentally challenged, you know, you name it, our country has done it. Having experiments on other populations that are not white because, you know, they wanted to see what STDs do, right? It can incorporate all of that, from being able to have children, to raise children the way you want them to be raised, vaccinating, not vaccinating, that can be a reproductive justice issue. Access to abortion, having an abortion, not having an abortion, all of those are reproductive justice issues. I feel what it really boils down to is the ability to let women make the choices for themselves that they are capable of making.
And how do you guys work on that?
So we've been involved in different networks and coalitions. We're part of Sister Song, which is a national organization of women of color and Indigenous women who've been advocating in the reproductive health arena for reproductive justice for women and people of communities of color. Here in New Mexico, we work in partnership with Strong Families New Mexico. Forward Together is the national organization, really looking at not stigmatizing teen parents, having access to birth control for our young people, having comprehensive sex education, to providing doula services for families who are first-time parents or just parents who are wanting support around childbirth and kids, promoting breastfeeding.
Doula is a term that maybe not all of our listeners know. It's the person who sort of helps the midwife, is that right?
Yeah, so doula, I mean, when we even look at breaking down language, doula is a term that means, like, somebody broke it down to, like, woman slave, slave woman.
Good heavens.
But it was, in a sense, that person that is helping support the birthing process, which in our ways, we've always had that practice. We've always had women who were present helping other women give birth. We've had midwives in our communities, medicine women who acted as midwives that were the people that helped with the birthing process. And so we call them our program Yiyavikegendi, which means the mother's helper.
Say the word again.
Yiyavikegendi.
It's nice to hear the Tewa words.
Yes. And a lot of our programming is around how do we bring in our Tewa language to describe, to support the ways that our young people will hear the language, not just in school, but outside of school and in different contexts.
So yet another piece of the work is seed sovereignty and the whole question of agriculture. And I think one of the things that it gets overlooked is that Indigenous agricultural practices here in the Southwest were really sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And you could grow great food with with the existing rainfall.
Yeah, right? And our knowledge of that has been taken away.
Is it gone or is it coming,
It's not gone. It's never been truly gone, but it's been discouraged, right?
Yeah.
In different ways. When you bring supermarkets to an area, right? You have the convenience of trucking in food from other places, which then offsets your economy here. But I think those communities that have a farming legacy, a farming history, are those communities that are going to survive. What we know of monocropping is that, once you monocrop and monocrop and monocrop, the seed is not as strong, is not as rich, and sometimes they can't even germinate. Right? You just get that one seed and that's it.
And the soil is no good.
And the soil is destroyed. I mean, it's horrendous, right? But this is what we've embraced as a country. And then this is what offsets the mom and pop farms. How do they compete? How do we do this? And in our indigenous ways, as new economies came in, then we moved away from our agricultural base, right? And so there are, I feel, very few farmers in our indigenous communities. It is making a revival. It is coming back thanks to those who have carried on that tradition. And it's really important, again, for us to look at the seed sovereignty piece is protecting those seeds that have been cultivated, been brought forward from generations to withstand, right? To withstand the droughts, to withstand in their particular environment, right? And so our farmers, our scientists, were the ones that cultivated those seeds so that they would be able to withstand in our indigenous way is like, they're like our children because we nurture them, we sing to them, we water them, we comfort them in different ways through their growth cycle so that you can have that beautiful harvest at the end. And it's not just one particular crop, you're growing them in relation to one another, right? Which has the right nutrients to grow and how do we come to that piece? And the waffle gardens, the dry farming, the permacultural pieces are like tried and true tested practices for thousands of years. And so we know that those are needed still now, and particularly now because we're in this climate change, climate water scarcity periods, which are often man-made. I just want to say thank you to all of those farmers out there who have continued to hold this practice for our communities.
One of the things that's important and interesting about Native communities here in New Mexico is that luckily you didn't get displaced, right? You were on lands that you, unlike many other Native people in the U.S., you know, have had to move to completely different climates and ecosystems and land. But still, there's this like surreal thing of like going about your own business for thousands of years, and then somebody comes in and says, this land that you live on belongs to this king of Spain. And you're like, who? You know? And then all of this encroachment, both violent and religious and cultural, from the outside. How do you keep the fundamental, the most important, like, values and practices of your own culture? I mean, I assume that there's been things lost, but there's also been a lot that hasn't been lost. How do you consciously hold on to that?
I remember hearing from my mom a conversation she had with another woman elder from another community who said that nothing is ever lost unless you stop practicing it. And so again, I'm grateful to those who have held in our communities the practices that have sustained us through. And I think sometimes in survival mode, we tend to close off and isolate. And I believe that that's happened in our communities in certain ways. And there's also a place in observing nature that you need to have openness, right? For oxygenation, you know, log placement on fires, different things. So I feel like we also need to be in a place of opening up, because I feel like some of that closeness has really harmed women in our communities, or the place that women held in our communities. And as we needed men to step in the most violent times in our community, we also need them to recognize that the women in their communities are strong, have a voice, are powerful, can make their own decisions, can contribute in other ways, other amazing ways than some of the limited pieces that men hold. Not all men, but men hold, right? And so I think that sacredness or isolation has protected us to this point. And now how do we open that up so that there can be more evolution, more growth, more perspectives coming into dialogue? Because I feel like communities and families that continue to have good dialogue, not like disowning, like we get in an argument, we disown each other, but those that can really grapple with stuff and hold those values, right? Like what you're talking about, like what are your community values? What are your family values? What are your personal values that you're not willing to compromise on, that you're willing to compromise on? That all of our lives, any of us, no matter what community we come from, it's about negotiation and evolving in that interdependence, right? The interdependence is like some behaviors that you did when you were roaming around by yourself aren't going to work when you're coming together in a community or a family or a practice. And there's also things that we choose to embrace and things that we choose not to embrace. But those are conversations that families need to have, that we need to share with our young people. Like, why do we believe in honesty in this family? Why do we believe in not harming other people in this family? Why do we believe, you know, why are we practicing this? Why are we choosing to practice this? Because I feel like sometimes adults and communities are like, well, our kids are getting this message, right? Well, your kids are getting all kinds of messages now because they have social media, they have Facebook, they have virtual friends from wherever that aren't even in their vicinity. We have media, news outlets, things that are telling us different things about people. And we need to be telling them from our perspective what our values and our feelings are so that they are able to kind of integrate that within their practice of how they move in the world. Not just saying like, don't trust this person because blah, 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 blah. I feel like we're in the place in this community, in this society, where a lot of that fear is because of someone's different than us. But I also think it's also because we, in some aspects, have not had those open conversations with our children, with our families, with our communities. I think right now we're in a place where society is saying no dissent, right? No protesting, no outright Standing Rock and others. They're prosecuting people for protesting. Yet that's a place where our biggest growth is, right? Because people are saying, like, this isn't working. Civil rights, this wasn't working. Like, all of these things, this is where we come from and how we got into this place of having protections for people because people were being murdered. And we're back in the place where people are being murdered. And so how are we as a community and society responding and reacting to that? And I think that goes to the value piece of being able to share and talk, not just for us as Indigenous people, but for all communities to have that conversation.
When you look back on your own history as a Tewa-speaking person, as a Pueblo person, is there a history of women having a place of strength, a place of authority, you know, leadership roles historically, like pre-conquest?
I think right now we're getting to Indigenous scholars that are really going into the historical records and seeing, right? We're having family members do oral histories and collect information and all of that. And yes, I believe that there was a place in time in our communities, because we see the remnants of it that still exist in our community, of who we pray to, of Mother Earth, and that we call her mother, that we know that there was this value. Again, the practices have been skewed. The practices have been saying it verbally, but not necessarily showing it with behavior. So how do we get back to connecting to that place of, like, knowing that women did have this huge and do still have this huge sacred space in our communities and hold a lot of power and hold a lot of strength, and to not fear it and to continue to embrace it and continue to reclaim practices, rematriation, all of those other practices.
Did you say rematriation?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So, like, just allowing women to have all of those practices in their community, right? Not necessarily needing a male to speak for you. Having your voice be recognized and honored and respected, really going back to, if we are centering on a mother in our communities, then we really need to recognize the power and strength that women hold and uplift that in a positive way and move away from where I feel we are right now in our societies because of outside influences and also just internal oppressions, seeing women as body parts, seeing women as not having that strength or that power, seeing women in a sexualized way and only in a sexualized way. Yeah, I think.
Yeah. Is there a history, do you know, of acceptance of gender nonconforming people, LGBT, etc., in Native worlds?
I know that there's some research on that has been done. I feel our communities embraced diversity in practice, because we talk about not just our physical form, we talk about energy, we talk about spirit, and all of those things don't necessarily have a sexual orientation, right? Like a sexual, physical gender. So I believe that existed. The embracing of all, right? Because we still talk about that philosophy of, like, being connected to the all and embracing all. And because of our observations with Mother Earth and with the cycles of the environment, that we know that there are animals that can, you know, procreate without males, and they can transform their gender, and they can do all of these things. So I feel, as Indigenous people, yes, we did have that practice.
So you've been working with Tewa Women United for a long time. It's now the 30th anniversary, and we can mention some of the things that are coming up that people are invited to, but I wanted to ask you before that, how has this work affected you personally?
Wow. So I always say, like, I grew up in the organization. My mother and family members from my community and my personal family helped in the organizing of Tewa Women United, and so I feel like I am a reflection of all of those different experiences. Being able to get my doctorate as a reflection of all of this work has been powerful. And in my healing of around my sexual violence that was directed at me, like, I feel like this, the work of Te Woman United has been key in that, the way that the women embraced healing, and healing on multiple levels through multiple practices, right? So from breath work, yoga, all like ancient traditions that cultures have used, and they've come to us and shared that with us, and then that we're able to then gift that to others as well, because that's what they asked of us, right? When they said, we're coming, we want you to share. And so being really kind of aware of those different pieces. So for me, it's like really impacted my ability to maintain hope in a lot of these times of violence and crisis, and to know that for me, they've given me the ability to say, like, we're working towards this. This is what we want. We know that this exists. There's this violence, there's these things. But what we're really working towards is creating that time in our vision when peace and mutuality of power and fluidity and sharing and all of that, and we're recognizing and seeing everything as sacred and powerful and connected. I really feel like that's been my takeaway from the work that we're doing at Te Woman United.
I have to say the idea that everything is connected is an ancient idea that science is sort of coming around to, you know?
I know, right? I'm like, hello? But we don't believe it until,
Yeah.
But then you have the science and people don't believe that climate change is happening. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's a PR issue that we can talk about in another show. But on the weekend of September 26th through 29th, I believe that's Thursday through Sunday.
Yes.
There's a gathering for Mother Earth, Water is Life, and that is something that people who might be listening to this can participate in, or some of it?
Yes. So on our website should be posted the days and where we're going to be, because we'll be traveling. And Kathy Sanchez and Beata Sosi Pena are the coordinators of the Gathering for Mother Earth. They run our EJ program, our environmental justice program. So you can contact them at the office, 505-747-3259.
And tewawomenunited.org.
Yes, our website.
And there's also on October 10th, a benefit concert with Buffy St. Marie at the Lensic. That's a big deal.
Yes. So Tewa Women United is a beneficiary, or one of the beneficiaries of this concert that Indigenous Solutions is putting on. And we are just really honored to be in partnership with all of them and excited, and we'll want to invite all of you to come out and check out Buffy.
And there's another event on October 14th at the Governor's Mansion. All of this can be found out with more detail at tewawomenunited.org. Is there anything else you want to let people know before we go?
We've just been really honored to have the amazing support of community, and community from Northern New Mexico, from all walks of life, from all corners of the world. Just feel really blessed to have you all on this journey. And we're starting our journey of generosity, which is in our European American way is our capital campaign. But yes, we would want to invite you to be on this journey with us and to join us in partnership. And you can always check our website. You can get on our email list so that you're kept aware of any events and things that are coming up. I will be speaking at a couple of murdered and missing Indigenous women events. One is at SIPI on October 11th, and I will be at Isleta on October 10th. Yeah, I think they're going to be also live streaming some of that stuff, so you're welcome to catch that.
Well, lots more to talk about, and maybe we can keep the conversation going another time. Corinne Sanchez, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Enjoyed it.
The Radio Cafe wants to thank all of our sponsors, including the Santa Fe Institute, the Lannan Foundation, and Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation. You make this program possible. Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lannan Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.